She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. So we're going to give you a lot of really amazing things to think about today. Take a deep breath and get ready for all of us to rock this. Our show today is made possible due to the generous support of the Chapman Automotive Group. They are doing their share. They are doing their share and showing they care. And we thank them for the support of Mrs. Green's World Movement and for everything else they do to make our planet safer and cleaner. Okay, the name of our show today is kind of deep, but stay with me. It's clothes that fit your morals. And I dare say a lot of people who buy clothing may not be thinking about how does clothing choice fit your morals. You're going to find out. Talk about giving you something to think about. So I have been waiting patiently for about 10 months to reconnect with this amazing organization. I know I can speak for at least one of them. He's very fun. He's outrageously fun, actually, creative. And I met him at a Social Venture Network conference last April. And Scott, I think I told you about 10 times, I'm going to get you on my show. I'm going to get you on my show. And you kept saying, yeah, Gina, I know you told me that. So here I am on the show. Please join me in welcoming Scott Leonard and Matt Reynolds. For over 20 years, their company has been helping to lead the fashion revolution by creating a company that reflects a commitment to sustainability, social entrepreneurship, and responsible actions by consumers and businesses alike. These two guys are not just fun. They're all about taking care of their people, their supply chain, and this great planet of ours. So welcome, Scott and Matt. I feel like we should have a drum roll. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. I told you. Let's ring the bell a little bit. I love to ring the bell. Okay, this is a bell ringer show. So
Gina, it's so good to be here. And you did say we were going to do this. And thank you for making us part of your world. It is just so awesome to be in Mrs. Green's world.
We are here, Mrs. Green.
So excited. So this is of course not ever in the questions that I'm asking, but it comes out of the whirling dervish brain syndrome from which I proudly suffer. But one of the ways how I met Scott was that we were at a Social Venture Network conference, which was truly life-changing and transformative for me on this journey. And someone said, do you know they're giving out clothes in this room over there? My friend Molly and I are like, what? So there was a whole fashion scene going on, and indeed Indigenous was giving out clothing and just created an excitement and interest on my part that lasted and will continue to last in the continuing education of Mrs. Green and all of my great listeners. So here's my first question, guys. I promise not to talk as much because it's all about you, but I wanted to set the tone as informative and raising the consciousness of our listeners, because that's what they listen to Mrs. Green's World for. But we kind of have to start on the dark side, because I don't think in general people refer to the fashion industry as I lovingly do, the filthy fashion industry. I don't think people are aware of the harm that this industry causes to our bodies, our planet, to the workers that make our clothing. So would you just mind giving us a little bit of the overview of the dark side? And then the rest of the show is going to be all about what you guys are doing to change that.
Great. It is a good place to start, because so many people really don't think beyond the first click in their purchase.
Right.
And, you know, it's the fashion industry, a lot of people don't realize this. This is a $2.5 trillion industry. It is the second largest contributor to global pollution, next to petroleum. Second highest user of water, which actually creates 20% of industrial water waste. And 80% of all fabric and textiles are not reused, and they end up in landfills. And then on the human impact side, a lot of people don't really realize that 1 in 6 people on the planet in some capacity work in the fashion industry, whether they're farmers, whether they're working in a manufacturing facility, dyeing facility, cut and sew facility, or in a retail store, or have a brand. And 80% of those workers in the supply chain are actually women.
It's just,
let's face it,
mind-boggling. Go ahead.
There's a lot of gender justice and human rights violations that are going on in these supply chains. And that is one of the reasons that we've created the model that we have around both organic fibers and also fair trade practices within supply chain.
You know, just I feel like saying, okay, can you guys repeat all those numbers? And I'm going to make my social media coordinator really listen to this show and put some of those facts out on Twitter. We have, you know, tremendous engagement on Twitter. And I just, this is the big bomb that dropped in my life about 4 years ago on this journey when I had Marcy Zaroff on the show. And I actually went to a green conference in New York and she presented. And I had my two daughters with me, and this will not be surprising. We ended up crying when she painted the landscape of what the fashion industry looks like. Thus, I coined the term filthy fashion industry. So it's like it's a very stark, dark, and not changing as rapidly picture. So, okay.
Marcy's a close friend of ours and is brilliant. And we've been in tears with her many times about the state of the planet and the state of the human condition within the fashion industry. It just needs to be cleaned up. And I think to your point, a lot of people are just not aware of it, Mrs. Green.
They're not. Nobody wants to say. I was telling Matt when I talked a little bit before the show, I used to go to Target, and for every holiday, I bought family shirts, you know, the mom. Let's all have matching 4th of July shirts. Let's all have matching St. Patrick's Day shirts. And they were $5. Well, now I go in there and I look, and my daughters are with me on this journey, and I say, I kind of feel like maybe the blood of slaves is on that shirt. You know, not a lot of people want to go shopping with me these days, but it's like, yeah, I recoil from that. And I'm sure that if you're buying a $5 shirt, there's pieces to this dirty side that I think consumers really want to know about. And you're going to tell us about those changes. And more importantly, you guys have solutions for what we can do. So let's go on the good news. Read a great...
Before we go on the good news...
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
There's actually a film and a person that I want to acknowledge. There's a film out there that... It's a documentary.
Okay.
And it actually talks about the true cost. In fact, the name of the film is The True Cost, and it's all about the fashion industry and the human condition and the environment and what we're doing to the environment through our purchases of fast fashion and things that are not good for our ecosystem. So Andrew Morgan, who is the person who made this film, also is a friend, and we've supported him. It's an amazing journey that takes you through through the entire supply chain, and it's not fun, and it's not for the weak-hearted, but it is very, very informative. That's The True Cost is the name of the documentary.
And it's very, very, very important that people listen and start. You know, I love that line, Jack Nicholson, the truth, you can't handle the truth. Well, we better start handling the truth because we're a global community. Okay, however, I will be contacting you, Scott, for his contact information because we want to do a series on the fashion industry and have a 6 to 8 part series. Our consumers and our listeners love series, so it would include you, it would include Marcy. We're scheduling Sass Brown. I'd like to interview someone from the Fashion Institute and say, what are you doing as leaders? What are you doing at FITM to do this? So anyway, okay.
Excellent.
Okay. Will you give me his contact information if I email you, Scott? Because he'd be a great show guest, and I'll watch the film.
Absolutely.
Okay. Another good thing happening. So this is really, to me, a great quote from something I read about your journey. Our path is chosen. Indigenous then and now. So now for the good news, I'd like you both to take a little bit of time or as much time as you want to talk with us about how your important journey started. It was over 20 years ago when I was still like not thinking about eco-consciousness. You know, I was an old hippie, so it was like about the war, but not about living a sustainable and socially just life in every way that that means. So what's your good news? How did you start, you revolutionaries?
Yeah, well, I think like a lot of revolutionaries that come into a new emerging market, they're kind of seen a little bit crazy. My wife at the time, actually, I should say my girlfriend at the time, who is now my wife.
I was going to say, okay, that sounds like another show.
Yeah, right. Even her, she had her doubts too. She said, "What are you guys doing? You're creating a fair trade
called indigenous."
Indigenous artisan based, you're going to produce these goods way high up in the altitudes of the Andes, you know, and it's going to be organic fibers. I mean, this is 20 years ago, and at that point, Whole Foods and the whole what we'd consider to be organic natural, you know, segment was just emerging. So, you know, Matt and I put our best foot forward to make a pledge. And that's why we say that our path was chosen. We really felt like we were walking into something that was needed, that was important, that a lot of people were not seeing. And that was creating an opportunity to really honor people and the planet in a for-profit business. On the way, we met a whole lot of folks on that path, including great people at SVN who you've met before, Social Venture Network. And, you know, I'd like to maybe give Matt an opportunity to talk about our journey as well. But the one thing I would say is along the way, we have met these people that we've embraced. And it has been, even if they're in the industry, it has been about collaboration. We try not, someone like Marcy is a great example. She's out there doing something very similar to what we're doing, but we don't see each other as competition.
Right.
We see each other as shoulder to shoulder, really trying to send a message, to not just in the United States, but globally, that you can make a difference and you can actually convert and turn supply chains into a work for good, not necessarily something that has to be painful and people, not only painful for people, but also detrimental to the planet.
And when you say that, it's like, this is the part that kills me when I get in arguments with people. That is a benefit to everybody, not just the people and the cultures you're preserving and the families you're helping. Raise the bottom of everyone and the whole planet lifts up. So I know I'm getting a little bit carried away because of my passion on this, and I want to keep going back to the show's all about you. So I'll just have these outbursts occasionally. So Matt, what about your journey? Very different than Scott's, but as impactful and as meaningful as you were being chosen.
Well, Scott and I have known each other since actually the seventh grade. And we've always had interconnecting circles of peers and friends, and have shared deep, deep passion for both the environment and also respect for indigenous peoples and cultures around the world. And so there's just been a kinship. And over the years of us growing up and then, you know, moving on into our own separate careers, we had mutual friends suggest that, you know, we should think about getting together and talking and sharing some of our vision, because we do have different stories and we have different skill sets that allow us to be the yin and the yang, so to speak, and really create a really full team.
Right.
And my background is I grew up as a child living in Central and South America, and deep down in my core, I learned early on that we share this world with many diverse people, and that for me, my true worth was defined by what I could give back, not what I could take from this planet. And when Scott came to me 20-plus years ago through a serendipitous event, which we often, Scott tagline phrase, I think he said, the sweet spot of indigenous is halfway between serendipity and sustainability, because we meet many wonderful people journey.
Yeah.
And when we connected at a mutual best friend's wedding, it was one of those moments when I was hearing the story and the vision that Scott had behind this startup called Indigenous Designs. Goosebumps were going down my back, and the fact that it was working in the Americas, which was where I was so passionate about myself through my family, and providing opportunities to those who needed it most through fair trade, and then doing it in a way that was also environmentally conscious, that wouldn't harm the planet. It was just too exciting to ignore. And we you know, we're dating ourselves, but we used to always say, okay, well, are you a diver? You know, like the nasty plunge. You just ready to take the plunge.
Right.
And we basically committed, and at that point it was like, you know, our path is chosen. You know, we're committed to making clothing that honors people and the planet, and that's what we're doing. And here we are 20 years plus later, and find ourselves running a multi-million-dollar fashion brand that stayed committed to the founding values and principles of what we started on. And that I think we're both really proud of that.
And the impact is immeasurable. Like, the more I went down the rabbit hole, the more I went down the rabbit hole of the, what I call the ripple effect of the kind of things you're doing. And Matt, I just want to make a comment on goosebumps. I was talking to somebody about that last night, and I said, you know, you can't fake goosebumps. When that happens to you, something's happening to you, and you should pay attention to it. So I love the goosebump conversation. Let's just talk about some of the basic terms and principles, because I need you guys to help educate me a bit more and our thousands of listeners who really care about this kind of information. Start with Indigenous clothing line. What's an Indigenous clothing line? What does that mean? Tell us what that term is.
So we are a fair trade and organic fashion company. And when we first started off, we were actually using only artisan-based Indigenous peoples. Now we've opened that up a little bit to economically marginalized communities as well, for scaling jobs in what we call the BOP, the base of the pyramid. So that is our model, is to create jobs in economically marginalized communities, to give opportunities that are fair trade, mostly to women, and to produce goods that are not only something that we can do to scale their skills and get a fair wage, but they're also good for the planet. So that means that we're only using natural fibers, we're using low-impact dyes, we're using certified organic, and we're in many cases using what's called the Global Organic Textile Standards, Okotex 100 dyes, and a number of different materials that are good for the planet. We could go technical, but what I think is more important, and by the way, Gina, I'm totally willing to go down the rabbit hole into the technical aspect of the environmental impact of what we do, and the different measures that we take. But I think for this crowd, it's what would be great to know is that there are indeed networks, not just Indigenous Designs, but there are now networks of us out there that are really trying to tackle global supply chains and make clothing that are better for people on the planet, and that there are going to be opportunities more and more for people to vote with their dollars.
And
now,
I go ahead. We're going to have to take a break in about 30 seconds, but I don't want to necessarily go to the technical side, but I'd love you to inform us about what is a scalable artisan network? What is an artisan? What does that mean and why does it matter? So when we come back, lots of information about some of the terms you use in your business and why it matters about the path of consciousness. Everybody stay here with me. We'll be right back. Quick break.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific time at mrsgreensworld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at mrsgreensworld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@mrsgreensworld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we are interviewing the co-founders of Indigenous. One big word, Indigenous Design, two big words, Scott Leonard and Matt Reynolds. And it's so impressive to me that for over 20 years, that's like nobody was on this, going to this party back then, or very few people, their company is helping to continue to lead the fashion revolution by creating and continuing to develop a company that truly reflects a commitment to sustainability, social entrepreneurship, and responsible actions by consumers and business alike. Thank you guys for taking the time to be with us and share your journey. So Scott, Matt, let's get back to some, I think it's jargon. Every industry has jargon or terms that you all know what they mean. And in our world, in the world of the massive consumer, lots of people know what organic is. They know what organic food is. They know what certified, USDA certified organic is. And you mentioned it a little bit. What makes a piece of clothing organic? What kind of things do you have to look for?
Yeah, so as far as being organic with clothing, let's take organic cotton as the example, because that's the primary fiber when it comes to being organic that we put into clothing. So it's 100% certified that there are no pesticides or defoliants that are used in the process of growing that cotton. And, of course, it's GMO-free. So this has to also go through the entire supply chain, so you can't add, like, really bad dyes to it.
Right.
Things that, for instance, azodioxin, and still keep that organic status. So you start clean. You end clean, and that's the part of being certified organic by a USDA accredited certifier.
And if you look on Artists of Clothing, you can find the seal. I mean, there's things that you can look for, and people can Google that. My best friend Google is my best friend to help me do these shows. Okay, let's talk about what is an artisan. What does that mean, and why does it matter? And it matters a lot, but people don't think of clothing. People that make clothing as artisans. So go a little bit into what's the definition of artisan?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start with talking about fair trade, because that's part of that human condition that leads right into our model with working with artisans. And Matt, maybe you can talk a little bit about the artisans and what that means to us. But I'll start by just going through what we consider to be our principles around fair trade that we've put into our supply chain, which is no easy task. But it's starting with the idea that we want to create opportunities for producers that are in economically marginalized areas. That's like a ground
huge.
That's like what we do, right? But you also have to develop fair and accountable relationships within the supply chain. This is another ground rule for us. So we have to be very transparent with information with our producers and get them actively involved in understanding what it is that we're doing together in a cooperative manner. And the next thing that Matt and I hold very true is maintaining long-term capacity building. We never want to be one of those companies that goes in, creates a widget, creates a 10,000 of these widgets. Let's just call it 100,000 t-shirts, and then the next year, nothing.
Right. Because move out. Next. Right.
That's right, because that really hurts. The peaks and valleys really hurt people. And for us, we really want to create those long-term relationships. For us, we've been with some of the same groups that we started with. That's 20 years down the road. So it's very important that you build and you build capacity sustainably and that you stick with it. This is a huge part of fair trade, right? And so we believe that promoting fair trade and mindfulness throughout our supply chain and to the consumer is a huge part of our journey as well. So, of course, along the lines of fair trade means you're paying a fair living wage, and you have to pay that in a prompt manner. This is also very important to what we consider to be the fair trade condition. And, of course, it's all about supporting a safe and participatory workplace that empowers the women that we're working with. We believe that voice matters greatly. We want to know every single artisan that's in our supply chain. Is that a daunting task? Absolutely. Is it impossible? Nothing's impossible. So we continue to be on that journey, and we stay in contact. And this is one of the ways that we can ensure that we don't have a lot of, like, for instance, no child labor. How do we guarantee that? Well, we get very involved in the community, and we make sure that there's no child labor that's going on, and it's not just about having one certifier come in, which, by the way, we do. It's about constant contact and education within the actual supply chain, right? And so we feel that when it comes to children, we want to make sure that we're supporting the women in our supply chain to give back to their children, to create education within the supply chain, to give security. And in a lot of cases, we support the schools that are in our communities. So community building is a big part of what we do, to cultivate that stewardship, along with also the environmental stewardship. That's, believe it or not, that's also part of fair trade. You can't be good to people and then come in and have them handling toxic materials, right? So environmental condition also feeds into fair trade. So, and then last but not least is probably a good way to talk, kind of lead into artisan, the artisans that we work with, these communities, and in some cases cooperatives that are in very hard to reach places, is we have to respect cultural identity of these artisans, of these communities. And so that's what that was a mouthful, but these are just actually just some of the main principles surrounding fair trade. So I don't know, Matt, maybe you can talk a little bit about our cultural preservation and artisans.
Sure. So you started out with the question, what is an artisan? And, for us, an artisan is everybody from the hand knitter, the weaver, to the sewer, to the steamer, to the finisher. It's a craft that is embraced and is honored, and that the person who is doing it is proud to be doing it. And we started out, clearly 20 years ago, Scott and I hiking through the Andes, meeting with really, really remote artisans. I mean, there was a time when literally our wool was washed in rivers. And clearly we expanded and built, from that starting point to now being able to provide luxury organic cotton Pima yarns to the best-in-class retailers in the United States. So it's a pretty exciting journey that we've been on. But along that path, it's always about, when we scale and build, respecting the heritage, the cultural heritage of the artisan communities where we work, because we work in some of the poorest, most remote regions throughout South America. We're scaling artisan knitting skills that have been time-honored for generations. And I always like to say kind of we blend modern design with old-world techniques. So if we are working with hand linking, we're hand linking seams of a garment that may have really strong European design details behind it.
Right.
But we're using traditional South American skills to link that. So it's kind of merging worlds together and doing it in a way that deeply, deeply respects and honors the Andean culture and traditions without harming the environment at the same time.
So part of it, of what you do and everything about you guys and your company and your website and your social media and the way the person answers the phone screams partnership. You are not purchasers or retailers and they're the suppliers. You build sustainable partnerships and communities in your life and in their lives. So when you talk about skills, I would assume that you find artists or you have found, you know, artisans in the past, but they do need to learn some new skills so that their products are scalable. Is that part of what your contribution is, your vast contribution, so that they are up to standards that are, you know, scalable? That's a tougher call.
Absolutely, and that's a really good point, because some of the skills that are needed are around that quality control, scaling a skill so that there's a great understanding of what the need for is in the market. And we found that it takes months and months and sometimes years to actually scale the jobs and the quality, to train the artisans to take a skill that they have to the next level, to where, as Matt was saying, I mean, it can appear on the world market in really, really premium stores, dictate a higher price point that then can convert, back to a better living wage for the artisan that made it.
Got it. Everybody wins. Everybody wins if you're doing it that way.
Exactly.
That is definitely the case. And we've done a few different things. We found that scaling within the quality control is one aspect of it, but also bringing what we consider to be financial literacy, financial acumen, so that there's an understanding the artisans themselves have to understand what it means to be making more money. How do we talk to them in the context of what's profitable for their household and what's not? So there's an entire deep dive that we take with the community to really understand and help the artisan to understand what they're getting, what price they're getting for the work that they're doing, how they can actually take better control of their lives, create better jobs in their community through this work, and actually coalesce and bring other women together to do the same. So what we try to do is spark entrepreneurs. That's a big part of what Matt and I do, is create entrepreneurial opportunities for these artisan women throughout South America. And we feel the same way here in the United States too, being part of things like the Social Venture Network.
Right.
And also trying to scale other entrepreneurs that are out there doing the right thing, creating jobs in a sustainable economy. Being part of things like BALI, you know, Business Alliance for Local Living Economy, being a B Corp, huge part of being a larger community. It comes back to really getting folks to participate and come together, be it the artisans or be it other organizations, other fashion companies. We can if we get together and we start talking about this stuff, gosh, I mean, Gina, it can make the biggest difference through the collaborations.
And we can get to the tipping point. You guys give me hope about the fashion industry actually moving the green needle forward in some really significant way. So, yeah, It's good. And I was at Bali too. I mean, it's when I go to those conferences, Scott, I want to live there. That's how I felt about SVN. Can we just stay here and talk about all these great ideas and how we're going to change the world? But let's go a little bit micro, because you really do help support people and families. It provides numerous benefits to them, to our planet, to global citizens, and you want to protect your supply chain. So give us an example, like with the alpaca herders. That's a sweet spot for me, about what you're doing to help protect them, to make sure that we have alpaca herders. Tell me what that looks like.
Yeah, we're working on a number of projects, actually, in the highlands. This is mostly in Peru. If you were to think geographically, it's on the border of Peru and Bolivia, out around the Lake Titicaca area,
okay.
stretching all the way back out to Cusco and then back around to Arequipa. And in that area, in the reserve, what we're trying to do is work with the indigenous people that are there, the herders, to get them a better wage for their alpaca. But it goes a little bit deeper. We believe that the alpacas that they've been herding and farming, so to speak, for generations, that there's a need to preserve the different colors of alpaca. Now, that's kind of a foreign thing to most people, but there are 16 different shades of alpaca.
You are kidding me.
Oh, no. This is... We got black to charcoal to light gray to more of a tan camel color to dark chocolate browns to mid browns, just a wonderful array of colors. Now, when we talk about the clothing industry, the fashion industry, we're often talking about dyes, right? What dye to use? Can we use a low impact dye? Gina, what about not using any dyes at all? What about some beautiful neutral colors that we can get consistently that don't use any dyes, and we can use these alpaca colors? Now, the problem is that throughout the globe, alpaca is needed in only white color because most folks want to dye it to the newest trend.
Right.
So over the generations, little by little, the different colored alpacas are becoming less, well, not only less popular, but literally the populations have been going down greatly. So indigenous designs is part of an alpaca preservation program, so we can use these undyed alpacas. And we're very proud that we actually also partner up with wonderful companies like Eileen Fisher.
Right, and another leader. Truly.
Another leader. And we actually produce for them with these beautiful alpacas. And we're able to work within the indigenous design supply chain, but we actually do private label for Eileen Fisher. They're just an amazing company to work with. And again, it's about getting companies together to create better goods. So we've been able to work these programs to a pretty high level so far. In the Andes Mountains, and we're really looking forward to moving this, moving the needle even greater, and helping the herders themselves to take better care of the animals, to preserve the color grown alpacas, and to utilize that in what we call our pure collection. So if you go to our website, you can look and you can find pure. And what that means is that there's no dyes that are used. We use no dye alpaca. We use no dye organic cotton. And a lot of people don't know that organic cotton also comes in color grown colors, such as light brown, dark brown, and different types of whites. So we're able to mix and match all these combined and marl yarns into beautiful textures and wonderful artisan-made, handcrafted, impeccably finished garments that we can sell for a premium value to the consumer, and again, get that money back to the artisans who made the garment themselves.
So we're going to have those things forever. And it's such a parallel between organic food and eating what's in season and re-educating ourselves, because maybe red clothing is not the hottest, best thing to be wearing this season. So we have to go to another break, and I say we have to, and I don't want to. Stay here with us, and we come back. Matt, I really want to get from you the sales and marketing side then and now. Everybody stay here with us. Lots more great stuff to cover. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. The name of our show today is Clothes That Fit Your Morals. I'm sure if you've been listening since the beginning, that makes just great sense. Please join me once again in welcoming two amazing thought leaders and revolutionaries in the sustainable fashion industry in every sense of those words, Scott Leonard and Matt Reynolds. Thanks for being on the show. Let me share again with our listeners, for over 20 years, your company has been helping to lead the fashion revolution, and there is one, by creating a company that reflects a commitment to sustainability, social entrepreneurship, and responsible actions by consumers and business alike. So you're creating partnerships between your products and the consumers. You're unstoppable, and I want to be a part of fueling that very sustainable, non-toxic burning fire, because it gets me really excited. So Matt, give us a little bit of the, you know, back in history, 20 years ago, what did the market look like then? Because you have in the division of labor, from what I understand, you're a lot of the marketing and sales end, getting placement in stores and boutiques. What did your life look like 20 years ago, and what's happening now? Do we have lots of reasons for hope?
Well, first, I want to start off by your saying, you know, when you go to Bali, you don't want to leave. Well, I just want to say, when I'm in Mrs. Green's world, I just want to stay here.
that's one of the nicest things anybody ever said to me. And just let me do this. We do Survey Monkeys, and we ask our listeners, and they're getting up to the 80 and 100,000 mark, okay, which has been a long journey. Who's looking for Mrs. Green's World? So we ask them if they want us to produce shorter shows. And most of those people say no, in a world where there's sound bites and 15 minutes.
Another hour.
Yes. A lot of our listeners write to us and say, can you have them back? Because of the quality of my guests and of what you're doing for the world. I think people want to know, and we have to find more of them. So thank you for honoring me with that, but I want to honor right back at you. You are content rich, and I have three more pages of questions, and we're not going to cover them, but talk about that, and thanks for shining the light on my important mission and vision. I was chosen to, in the rainforest, did go to Cusco. Not Cusco. Where did you say? I'm sorry. I went to the Sacred Valley. I went to Machu Picchu. I went deep in the rainforest. Yeah, Cusco. Cusco. Cusco is a food. Cusco. Okay. Sacred Valley. Never wanted to leave there either. So go ahead, Matt. Come on. We're back on track. That whirling dervish. I didn't take my medication. I don't take medication.
Back in 94, 95, I would say that today and then, I was as excited about the opportunity of the organic and fair trade fashion movement, but in different ways. In 95, there had actually been some some people out there in the late 80s and early 90s that were trying to bring in sustainable fashion. In Europe, I had lived a stint in Germany, and I saw organic fashion in 93 that really inspired me before I even knew the brilliant idea that Scott was coming up with. The difference is that it was a much smaller niche, and the mainstream awareness was practically nil, you know.
Right.
When we committed to going 100% organic cotton in 95, people would say,
"What's that?
Well, can you eat it?" We were one of the first companies actually to launch a nationally distributed hemp and New Zealand wool sweater.
Or can you smoke it?
Can you smoke it? And when we said that we wanted to build a scalable cottage industry socioeconomic production model back in 95, people said, impossible. You could never scale cottage industry. You're working in, you know, politically volatile regions. You've got natural disasters. You've got the complexity of the international freight. Where, how do you keep quality control standards up? And we had, I would say, just lines and lines of naysayers that were telling us what we were getting ourselves into was impossible. And like Scott alluded to earlier, nothing is impossible when you put your mind to it, and especially when it's fueled by a deep burning passion to make a difference in the world. And that passion has kept us going. And I won't say it was easy. The first 10 years was an incredible learning process. Trial and error. Building up ways and systems that work that maintain the integrity of our organization, at the same time holding retailers' attention. So in
right.
the early years, we actually really were a lifestyle brand, not so much a fashion brand, and we were working with a lot of outdoor stores that were passionate about the mission we were doing and wanting to keep us going while we work through these problems. And we are forever we just love those retailers that have been with us for so long. And then about 10 years ago, I would say, there started to be a shift. And we started recognizing that some of the better end retailers were poking their heads up and curious about this movement. And, you know, there were other people like Marcy and like Patagonia that were right there alongside us, pioneering and educating about the movement. But we felt and we saw that in order to maintain our fair trade side of our model, working with better and better quality raw materials, i.e. Pima cotton, but ensuring it's grown organically, or Royal alpaca or baby alpaca and ensuring it's processed in the strictest environmental standards, well, the costs were going up and up. So what did that mean? That meant that we had to put the pressure on our design team to really come up with amazing designs and an impeccable quality to meet the standards of the best in class fashion brands around the world that weren't necessarily fair trade or organic at all. But in order to bring what we call premium value to the marketplace and ensure that we elevate the lives of the artisans that make the product and continue to not harm the environment, the very nature of our model kind of put us in a position to have to offer a premium product, not a luxury product. We didn't want to be a luxury brand because we were seeing emerging organic fair trade brands that were really high end, you know, $500 to $1,000 to $2,000. we didn't want to be there. We wanted to be under $500 retail price points. But that's a premium price point. So you have to have premium value. You have to have something that's going to last. And that was inherent in what we did. We always made product that was going to last.
Forever and not fall apart and not be a piece of crap. I don't want to use crass language, but I mean just crap. You buy crap. Like I go into my one of my favorite Targets, and I will pick on them because it's my show. But like Forever 21, it's like, are you kidding me? This is like, it makes me sick, and not to mention how much it smells in there.
Look at it as we're an investment shopping.
I love it.
Price per wear. How many times are you going to wear that shirt that you bought for $20 and you wash it and it starts peeling up or holes start appearing in the fabric and you're out there and you're buying another one? Before you know it, you've bought 10 of those shirts in a year. Wouldn't you rather spend $100 for that same design that's made impeccably, that you know you're going to be wearing season after season after season? And that's how we try to, that's what we put into the thought process when we make something. It's classic, not conservative, it's classic design that's timeless, that transitions effortlessly from season to season, that is contemporary yet wearable in what we call versatile settings, versatile fashion. And that has brought us to a place now where, you know, today we're selling to, you know, hundreds and hundreds of best-in-class retailers throughout North America and Canada, and through catalog companies and through special makeup programs with department stores and great brands like Eileen Fisher, all doing it in this 100% committed, social and environmentally responsible way, and that's not very common that you find that. And I think that we are just so deeply committed to changing this industry and helping it morph into something that it can be. The opportunity is so ripe. When Scott talks about the base of the pyramid, In the developing world, the fashion industry, the filthy fashion industry, has so much opportunity to be improved, and it isn't overly complicated to do that. It just takes a lot of collaboration.
It is, and you really hit on a point that I am so hot on this point and get excited about it when I'm hoping to educate people. It takes a reframing of your thought process when it comes to your budget. And one of the members of the Mrs. Green's World team went through a really challenging time before she came to work here, and she had to go on food stamps. And she decided that she would eat less, but remain committed to organic and healthy food because she believed that was in her best interest. It was more expensive. I believe it's incredibly more nutritious. But it's a budget item, and some people say they can't afford organic. Like some of my friends, and I'll say, well, how many lattes did you have this week? Like, just factor that back into your budget. And it's the same with clothing. And my daughters are perfect examples. Hot, hip, happening, fashion forward. And when my daughter was going to USC, she said, Mom, I can't afford $125 jeans. But I can go get them at, you know, and I do pick on Forever 21 a little bit. We might, you know, bring them over from the dark side. But I said, Em, those jeans, how many times can you wash them before they fall apart? She's turned. She's morphed over. So now she has fewer pairs of jeans and ones that she will have forever. And you know, shame on me for not telling people at the beginning, and we'll do it when we do a lot of the promotion about this. But listeners, go to indigenous.com. And I kind of like double dog dare you to spend less than a half hour there. It talks about the apparel. It talks about the artisans. It talks about, there's a discover section. And you can learn about Scott and Matt's philosophy and their company they've created. Ethically made fashion, organic and natural materials. And I have lots of listeners who are mothers. This clothing is safer for your body. It's healthier to bring into your house. I mean, it goes to the health of the planet, but our own personal health. So there, that was another rant. I think it's the only one I did this segment. It's like, let's go, guys. Let's go to indigenous.com. And I'm going to buy a sweater there that I saw. There is a clearance section for all you bargain shoppers out there like I am. And there's a clearance section. So there's a, you know, a sweater there. It's the Raglan pullover that's on sale. And it's, you know, I can't wait to have that and to share it with people in my circle of influence and saying, you're not going to believe this, because they're going to love the sweater. And I'm hot, hipping and happening at 65. So, okay. I hope you guys are laughing.
We are.
Okay, good. I can't hear that laughter, but okay, let's talk a little bit. I'm thinking about the next three shows I want to do with you, because there is a piece about, and you addressed it somewhat, affordability. And did I really cover that? It's we want people that are living in marginalized communities that don't have big budgets to be able to figure out how to fit this in, maybe not on a grand scale, but change that thought process, because we want ultimately to get affordability for the masses. What are your thoughts on that happening in our lifetime? Because it doesn't in any way diminish the good that you are doing in every other way. Like those artisans can now afford to buy things. You know, I totally get that in the circle. But what about affordability for the masses? I guess my question is, what has to happen to bring that to our reality in this lifetime or somebody else's?
Well, I think you brought up a really good point, Gina, and that is that you can probably do more with less. You yourself said that one of the people that works on staff was able to purchase maybe a little bit less food but better quality. And I think that that is key right now from a consciousness standpoint.
Yes.
Can't we do that? We don't have to have more. We can do a little bit less and have a better quality food. We can have better quality clothes. Gosh, we can have better quality conversations. You know, I mean, literally, I think you hit on the theme. And although it might be tougher for someone that's economically challenged to buy an indigenous garment, one thing that Matt and I believe is that these garments are built to last, and that is super key. And I think to answer your question more directly, what we're up against for the future is mindshare. So.
Oh, I love it. Hashtag mindshare. Let's get that one out there.
In the theme of you saying, like, converting people from the dark side, it may the force be with you. Like, literally getting people to sort of understand that there are opportunities. So you can easily participate if you are on a lower income. I'll give you an example of what I've done, even in my own household. Although my wife refuses to go to Goodwill with me, I take my daughters. I'm like, come on, guys, let's go. And I actually show them about what we call the make of the garment. I turn the seams inside out. I say, hey, by the way, this is a really well-constructed garment. And I tell them, and they think it's fashionable, and they're like, oh, my gosh, that's great. And, you know, we get out of the store, you know, I give them a budget of $20 to $25, and they've got several items.
Now, so good. I want to ring the bell for that, Scott. I am a Goodwill shopper.
Ring the bell.
We have a video on their Goodwill Industries home page of Mrs. Green go shopping for Christmas and did my whole dinner table. You know, I have dishes, but we were just showing how you could go to Goodwill, showed how much it cost, and then we did the whole ugly Christmas sweater thing. They have great Christmas sweaters. So here's the sad part, you guys. We are out of time. And so on air, I want to put you on the spot and just ask if when we do the food series, I mean the series on filthy fashion, I won't call it that. It'll be fashion forward or something like that. Can we get you back? I know you're busy. I know there's a lot to do, but can we get you back to be a part of that series? Because there's so much more you have to share.
Absolutely.
Drum roll, please.
Yes, drum roll, bell binging. I mean, I can't tell you.
Yeah.
And I will tell you this. If you need me, if you need our message, if you need Mrs. Green's World to help you in any way we can, Gina at Mrs. Green's World. We've got a growing tribe and they want to be a part of this. You guys, thanks for showing up in my life and thanks for what you do for the planet. Make it a great green week, everybody.